Welcome to the Bring It Home podcast, and welcome to this final episode of the limited series called Hope in the Hard. This one came out of nowhere, and I'm so excited, and this interview ended up being so good that it had to be the last one in this series. So I was talking to Richard Paul Evans. He was episode 4 of this limited series, and I was telling him just a little bit about why I was doing the interview and what we were going to do the interviews for, and he said, oh my goodness, Matt, I've got somebody you need to talk to. You need to talk to Celeste Edmonds. And I said, well, who's Celeste Edmonds? And he said, well, she's the executive director of my organization, the Christmas Box International, or just Christmas Box International. And he said she's also written this book called Garbage Bag Girl. And so I got her information from Richard, and I called her up, and we started corresponding, set up an interview, and oh my goodness, such a dynamic human being. You're going to absolutely love this interview to round out the limited series Hope in the Hard. So enjoy this time with Celeste Edmonds. Celeste, welcome to the podcast. So great to have you. This was it just like happened to be. It was meant to be because I was hanging out with a friend of yours for this podcast as well, Richard Paul Evans. And we were just talking about the idea of hope in really challenging situations. And he said, you know who you need to talk to? You need to talk to my executive director of my nonprofit, Celeste. And I was like, that sounds great. If you think I should talk to her, I will. So why don't you just introduce yourself to the listeners? And I mean, you can share anything that you want, but a little bit about who you are and what you do. And then we'll jump into anything else that happens to come along.
Awesome. Thank you. Yes. So I'm Celeste Edmonds, executive director of the Christmas Box International. And we launched 28 years ago. Richard Paul Evans, who you were referencing, a good friend of mine, wrote a little green book called The Christmas Box. And when it became a national bestseller, and he and his wife made quite a bit of money off of that book, and he decided, okay, I'm going to be a full-time author, but we really want to give back to the community, but we're just not really sure the best way to do that. I had been working for him for about 2.5 years. He knew that I was raised in the child welfare system and had very strong feelings about experiences that they have in the system and ways that we can make change. And he also knew, was learning much about what had happened personally in my life. And so we decided they knew that they wanted the book the money they were going to give to benefit children, because the book is based on the loss of a child. Mm-hmm. So we held a child welfare conference here in our state in Utah, up at our graduate school of social work. And we invited about 160 child welfare advocates. And we asked, what is the single most important thing we can do for abused children? Well, ironically, Utah was one of about 9 states that was being sued at the time by the National Center for Youth Law in California for the mistreatment of children. And we actually had kiddos dying in the foster care system. And so we had this opportunity where there was this influx of funding from Richard Paul and Carrie Evans. And then there was this great need. Our state was in a lot of trouble. And then we had me, kind of this knowledge base of, I can tell you what it was like at that time. And so we formed our charity, the Christmas Box International. And now, fast forward 28 years strong, we have provided shelter and services for over 155,000 children, which is kind of hard to get your head around. That's a lot of kids. It's enough to fill Madison Square Garden more than 7 times. But it's children who are specifically taken into state custody by our state because of abuse, neglect, abandonment, trafficking, and the kids become wards of the state. And so the Christmas Box houses are emergency shelters named after the book. There's 3 of them in our state, and they hold children ages 0 to 18, which allows us to keep the siblings together, which is, you know, I always say shelter care itself is not what's unique. It's the fact that we keep all the way to age 18 and we're able to keep more than 1,000 siblings together every year. Most shelter care programs for children due to licensing only takes kiddos up to about the age of 12. And so those siblings, you know, naturally they get separated because they're older. And so keeping the sibling groups together is really what offers hope and strength, and that keeping that bond together is going to be the last thing that they have when everything else in their life has been completely taken from them. So that's a pretty unique part of the program. And it also allows us to buy time so that we're not, which is what put our state in trouble, we're not just removing kids. And as a police officer told us, when we asked, where's that 2-year-old that just got half of his hair ripped out of his head going to go? And he said, honestly, to the first person that answers the phone. And that's not necessarily the best place for that child, right? But it's out of emergency of not having a place for him to go. What else are they going to do? And so the Christmas box house allows time for the state and social workers and all the people in that child's life to make the very best decision on, hey, can they go home under a safety plan with the state, which would be the best outcome for them if that's an option? Or do they, we have a family member, like a grandparent that can, that is able, right, to take kids? Or do they need to go into foster care? But the hope is that that process is slowed down and we're not just immediately putting them into the first place available. We're hoping that it's right, but it's not most of the time because no due diligence was done. So it buys that time for us. Kids stay with us about 2 weeks to a month while that process is happening. And yeah, so that's kind of a little bit about what we do, or a lot about what we do.
I love that I asked to share about yourself and like you just roll right into the Christmas box, because, you know, I mean, as a person that's very passionate about justice issues in our world as well, and a nonprofit worker myself, like you do, you just like your passion and your life, they're all rolled into one.
Well, you ask about me, that is me. It's my children are raised now, you know, they're adults. My oldest son has a son, and it is now my life. Also the decision to write my book and publish it, Garbage Bag Girl, that was published last December 3rd, this past December 3rd, so just a few months ago. It's my memoir being raised in the child welfare system, which naturally obviously ties into what I do. So when I talk about me, it's like, that's just all who I am. I'm married to my work. I'm in love with what I do. I get the benefit of helping about 14,000 children a year. And it's like, it is who I am. My own kids, you know that this is it. This will be my legacy. You know what I mean?
I love it. I love it. I get so much joy, and it just lights me on fire when I meet people like you that are doing great work in this world, and it gives you hope. It does. When you engage with human beings who are passionate about things that matter, it helps us all to understand that in a lot of ways our world is in good hands, because I think there's more people with beautiful hearts and genuine goodness than there are the opposite of that. So when you say the words child welfare system, no matter who you are, something pops up in your head, and people listen to this podcast from all over the place. And so, everybody based on where they live, based on what their upbringing was like, based on what they were taught, what they were told, et cetera, they have different views of what that means to them. Can you share just from your own personal story, when we say child welfare system, when you were growing up when you were experiencing that, what were you experiencing, and how would you kind of define what is meant when you say that?
Yeah, thank you for that question, actually. It is important, because I don't just say I was raised in foster care. I was raised in a system that, as soon as the state made the decision to remove me and my brother and sister, it was like an ongoing cycle of, we were either with our parents because they were given a chance for reunification under some guidelines, and they were, you know, we were maybe at a hotel, or we were staying with family trying to figure it out, or that wasn't working. So oftentimes we were in a drug rehabilitation center with them, going through a program that they were going through. Many times we just stayed with a family member, and while they were in the drug rehabilitation center, then sometimes we were in foster homes. And so for me, moving every 6 months, and from the age 8 to the age of 16 was just super normal. I probably lived in over 31 cities. Keep in mind, I was also in child welfare in the early 80s. And so it's been really interesting in writing my book and interviewing my own biological family, and then now working in the state system, ironically, in the system that, by the way, 100% failed me. But I have learned through the process that it is, in my experience, better for people in any way that have been wronged about anything. It doesn't even matter if it's child welfare. I personally believe for your own healing and your own benefit of how you're going to grow and, you know, be productive and be the best version and be healthy of yourself, you have to get in it to some degree and understand the why it all happened. And then if you can find the passion in that, like I have, and recognize that, okay, it isn't that people were necessarily wronging me sometimes, but oftentimes it was a complicated system of all those transitions that were happening, and the belief system and the policies of the system at that time. And I'm unfortunately just trapped in this world of it. And how can I make a difference today by partnering with those organizations and helping them understand how we can do better? And that is far more healing than if I would have chosen, you know, I'm just going to be very bitter about it. I'm just going to say I was wronged and it was unfair. And it isn't that all those things aren't true, but it is unuseful. You know what I mean? It is like unuseful to have that perspective when now I get to have people listen to me, which counters when I felt like I didn't even have a voice. Nobody was listening to me then. Now people are listening and they're asking questions and they're curious. And so the child welfare system to me is explained as just the whole complicated process of there's courts and there's family meetings and there's programs for the family, and the child is kind of caught in this, I'm in the middle of all of it while you guys are just kind of all figuring out what's best for me. And maybe some things are better that's happening, and oftentimes they're not always better. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't guarantee that we remove a child and we're guaranteeing they have a better life outcome. There is no guarantee with that. We certainly are hoping that's the case. That's what we're striving for. But the reality is, we don't know that. We don't know that for certain. And it's very, very complex. And in the early 80s, again, when I was in child welfare, there was this very ineffective belief system that, okay, you're an older child. So I was the age of 8 when I started going through that process. Your chances of being adopted drop 50% once you reach the age of 4 anyway, because most people want an infant. So every year I got older, everybody kept telling me your chances of being adopted are so slim. So one, we're going to keep moving you every 6 months because you're not going to be adopted anyway. So you probably shouldn't attach to that family. Fast forward today, we know that mentality is very unhealthy. We want people to attach all the time, even if it doesn't work out. We want them to learn, you know, how to bond and how to connect with people. And so there are people my age, I'm 50, and I talk to people, you know, in their 50s and 60s that were in child welfare during that time. And there is an extreme disconnect oftentimes in their ability to connect because those transitions were so fast and the system was trying to set them up to not be able to do that. And now they have these long-term ramifications of relationship issues and toxic relationships and making unhealthy decisions. And
And I think that's so great to remember that so many people are caught within the context of a system, whether we're talking about child welfare, whether we're talking about the justice system, we could put a million different things on the table and understand that, hey, this isn't an individual person issue. This is a systemic issue that's much bigger. And the fact that you're willing to kind of partner with those organizations speaks very highly of you. If you don't mind me asking, we're all on some level like products of our environment growing up. And you just talked about that they were intentionally trying to help you not get attached during a time in your life when that's what you needed relationally in order to, in many ways, succeed outside of childhood. Were there things that helped? I mean, feel free to share any struggles that you had, but more importantly, were there things or people or opportunities that came into your life that helped you overcome that lack of attachment that you experienced growing up?
Yeah. So one of the things I often get asked when I speak, as a matter of fact, it is the number one question. I always get asked, why did you turn out so successful and many don't? I always get asked that question. And one, I think I get asked because people make a natural assumption that kids in the system are going to fall into the statistics of being unsuccessful. And they have it in their head that that's not what it looks like for them. So now I really answer differently than I used to, which is, why wouldn't they be a CEO? Why wouldn't they be an executive director? Why wouldn't they have the same opportunities? And it's kind of a reverse question of what's, you know, being asked to help people start thinking, yeah, you're right. And the reason I answer that way now is because I'm trying to help change the psychology of how we actually even speak to children in care. You know, I was discounted all the time and told, it's okay. Oh, you don't have to do that. You know what? You've been through a lot. Oh, you know what? You don't even have to go to school. You don't have to graduate. You know, you're probably going to be a teenager and be pregnant and not, you know, all the things. Like, I was so discounted for so long because people felt bad and they kind of wanted to let me off the hook a little bit. And that never benefited me. But through writing my book, I went through this amazing process of intentionally needing to write about the people that did step up. And in those transitions every 6 months, there was always an individual, someone in my life that now I've identified that I'm circling back with to say thank you. That even if it was for only the 6 months or 2 months or 4 months, they made a huge impact. Either there was their example just by watching and the nature of who they were was greater than anything I'd ever seen. They might've had a success. They might've just given me a place to stay for a few months, but they stepped up. They were put into my life. The universe sent them at exactly that time that I seriously needed somebody to just say, you're not really a garbage bag girl, Celeste. You really are more than that. And then sure, I would go right back into some chaotic, weird situation or abusive situation. And then another person, the universe would send me this other great person that would remind me that I was capable. And that happened to me throughout my whole life. And the book really, really did help me bring awareness to myself that those people existed and they still exist today in all of our lives. And I think when we're in the midst of chaos and when we're in the midst of just turbulence and things going wrong in our life, it is very easy by nature to forget about those people. It just is. They're not as obvious, right? You just think you're either having a lot of bad luck or all the things are going wrong. And so it's easy to dismiss the people that are trying in their own way to put their hand out to you, to reach out and ask, you know, how they can help. And that looks different for everybody. But I think it is important to pause, especially as adults. It's harder to do that as a child. You don't really know how to recognize it always. But when I think by the time you become an adult, I think if you can make an active effort to pause and look for a person, especially when you're hurting, it's the most beneficial, I find, if you do it when you're hurting, find anyone in your life that you can say, thank you for being in my life. Thank you for helping me in whatever way that looks like. Thank you in general. It changes your trajectory into this new place of gratitude. And it's so much harder to even stay in that other place mentally, the more you can keep doing that. And then pretty soon, I think you create a habit of that. So for me, that's kind of my system. People will know when I'm text happy, and I'm reaching out and I'm texting everyone in my network and asking them how they're doing, I'm hurting the very most.
Interesting.
And I think some people are picking up on it now. Like, Do you need a hug?
I love that. I think that so I think our world moves too fast. I think we're all too busy. And I think one of the biggest challenges that comes with a world that asks us to move this fast is that we don't often take the time to see the person in need, the person, and it's like these sacred moments in life. It's not that there's certainly going to be people that are lifelong people that we get to have a relational impact on for many, many years. And then there's these other sacred moments, whether they're 6 months or 1 minute, where if we all are honest with ourselves and think back at our life, there's been moments in our life when somebody said something or somebody
Absolutely.
did something, and that may have even been the only time you met that person or the only time you had a meaningful interaction with them. But for me, when I think about those few moments, like it changed the trajectory of my life. And to
Yes.
remember that as we're going through our days, that be aware of who's around us, be open to a conversation, make time for conversations or acts of kindness or whatever it whatever the universe puts in front of you. As a person of faith who that's been important to me for a long time, you know, my the tradition that I have because of where I grow up is have grown up as a Christian, and the person at the center of that is Jesus. And the thing that I've always thought about Jesus is he just seemed to respond to what came in front of him in any given moment. And I think that's what I respect about him more than anything else, is that he had this ability to just live a life at a pace that would allow him to engage in meaningful ways, even if it was just for 1 moment, and then, you know, quite possibly change somebody's life, whether that was a conversation or anything else. And so I love that. I love that you shared that, and that even in the midst of your turmoil, you know, I worked for an anti-human trafficking organization for a while as well, and we would talk a lot about that, about you can't see it. You can't see them. You can't see these, especially young people, you can't see them. They don't stand out. They actually are very hidden. And in a lot of ways, that's because
That's
of what
right.
they're going through. And so the importance of us having eyes that can see the people that don't stand out is so vital. Okay, I don't want to miss this because if you haven't been surrounded by this world and you hear the title of your book, Garbage Bag Girl, you may not have a clue of what you're talking about. So I'll let you describe it, but share where that title comes from.
It started off with just the natural evolution of me moving every 6 months and putting all my things in a garbage bag, which oftentimes still happens today. Not kids that come to the Christmas box house. No one's there. No child's left here ever with their stuff in a garbage sack.
I did not assume. I figured that was the
Just for the record, but
case.
I will meet, caseworkers who will say, yeah. Unfortunately, it is the case because if you're removing a child in the middle of the night and that's all you have to grab and put their stuff in, like what else are you going to do? And I understand that from a logistics standpoint, but having grown up with that, I became literally a garbage bag girl. But what it's really evolved into is much more about the mentality of how I began to view myself as nothing more than the things I would put in and take out that never really belonged to me anyway in that bag. And how quickly I was discarded like trash that would go in a trash bag. And it ended up creating a really, the book ends for really ends, takes place from age 8 to when I was adopted. And there's 25 more years that happen after that book that even though the book
And
ends.
what age were you adopted at, Celeste?
So the first time I was adopted into an abusive family at the age of 9 as a Christmas present to a sister. And the woman, the mother was Kathy, was extremely psychotic, and it was just a very, very tough time. And I ran away when I was 15, and I continued to house hop and live on people's couches and move every 6 months. And then I ended up landing at this woman's home named Carly, who I call mom today. And she made a comment about 2 months after I moved in when my friend Lisa, now my sister, asked her, do we have to keep her? And Carly says, yes, honey, we have to keep her. That home is where they have to keep you. And I was like, kind of dismissive about it, like, okay, I don't even know what that means. And no one's ever used the word home in that context with me before. So I didn't really think much of it. And then I was, a couple of weeks later, I was in the kitchen doing dishes, because that's one of the things I picked up in foster care is people would ask you to move less if you cleaned well. So I was doing the dishes and she walks in and she asks if she can talk to me. And I literally had that moment of, okay, it's that time. This always happens about every 6 months. Somebody comes in and they apologize, I can't stay. And then they help me make another transition. And I was thinking in my brain, wondering where my garbage bag was, the black garbage bag that I always had. So I'm immediately going to that place. And she said, would you like to live here? And I was like, live like for a couple more weeks? Like, I don't know what it means. And she said, no, do you like to live here? Would you like to live with me and my girls? She was a single mom with two teenagers. So I was the third teenage girl. She definitely didn't need more teenage girls.
Right.
And I said, well, short answer is yes, but why would you ask me? And she says the phrase, which is a token phrase for our family today, because honey, home is where they have to keep you and we would like you to stay. And I was told, I can remember vividly where I was standing, how it made me feel, the direction I was facing. I remember that day so clearly. And I was just, my breath was taken away. And I said, yes, thank you, please. Yes, I would very much like to. And so the joke became, because I was dropped off in a Winnebago at her house 2 weeks before Thanksgiving. And the joke became, I came for Thanksgiving dinner and never left.
I
and
like that.
Every Thanksgiving just became another anniversary. So on our 9th anniversary, I make a toast to the family and I say, hey, I've never lived in a family this long. I just want to thank you for letting me stay. And she literally jumps out of her seat and she shares a story that her own biological children didn't even know, which was that she had lost a child. And that was at a time when moms were kind of just sent home and you just keep moving on, so you never grieve. And she said, I was always supposed to have a baby girl, and that was you. And I would like to adopt you. And I'm like, well, it's okay. I was married at the time. And I'm like, I call you mom and my kids call you grandma. It's okay. Everything's fine, really. And she said, no, I think this would be really important for us and really important for you to know that this is your home and you don't question that. And so I was 26, and come to find out, by the way, if anybody's interested, you cannot just go change your birth certificate as an adult.
No, you can't just do that.
It's like I was thinking, what the heck? I'll just go to the courthouse. I'll fill out a form.
Just get some whiteout. It should be fine.
So we go to the courthouse and we have to hire an attorney. We go before a judge. The judge has never done an adult adoption. So he was so happy. He couldn't quit smiling because usually it's hard. And he says, well, I guess maybe you guys should say something. And I liken it to wedding vows. My mom and I are holding hands and she leans in.
So
she's
beautiful.
Like, well, what are you going to say? And I was like, I don't know. What are you going to say? So she shares the story about the loss of her daughter and me coming and all the things. And then I have this very profound moment where I say to the judge, you know, 16 years ago, I was in what's today is our county courthouse, literally and figuratively behind us in the road across the street, standing in a judge's chambers at the age of 9, scared to death to talk about the abuse I was experiencing and being told how lucky I was that anyone would want me because I was an older kid. And I was just like, yes, sir, to all of his questions, and how miserable it was at that time in my life. And I said, now look at me with that behind me. And I'm literally facing forward in this beautiful new courthouse with 50 people in this room that love me. And for the first time, I am very lucky and I chose to be here and this family chose me and I'm super grateful to be here. And it ended up being this, okay, she was right. I was supposed to have this. I was supposed to have this moment in my life where it doesn't matter how old you are. It's never too late to find home. That doesn't, no matter how old you are, that doesn't become no longer an option for you. You still get to find that.
Oh, that's like a tearjerker story. So I came across.
Well, that's the book. That's the book.
You just
welcome.
Gave the whole book away.
You're
Come
welcome.
On, Celeste. This quote came to me this morning. So my youngest is a big Winnie the Pooh fan.
my favorite. I have a tattoo.
Yep. And they're 18. My youngest Augie is 18 years old and still just has been a Winnie the Pooh fan since a little child. And now still. And so I came across a Winnie the Pooh quote this morning that seems so appropriate to what you were just saying. And this is from Winnie the Pooh when she says, "I always get to where I'm going by walking from where I have been." And I just thought, that's just so
that's
true.
Very appropriate.
And profound. Winnie the Pooh is always so damn profound.
I always quote from Winnie the Pooh. It's
right?
Our family. Yeah, we have matching tattoos now, my children and I. And
my two kids have matching Winnie the Pooh tattoos. That's just trippy.
You know, once you're in with Winnie the Pooh, you really can't betray and go another way.
No, there's no going back. You cannot cheat on Winnie the Pooh.
You're either a Pooh fan or you're not.
you deal with really hard things, and I know firsthand like how challenging that can be, and most of the nonprofit world that is what it is, and it can wear on a human, it can wear on a soul, it can wear on a just your like there's so many times, there's several times in my life where you just felt like you're living on the edge because you just can't stop, but you can't keep going. And so, and I think there's
can't
a lot of
quit it.
Yeah, like I can't quit, but I just can't imagine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine getting back into that tomorrow. And I think the reason I kind of did this mini series is because I think that's the way a lot of people feel about the world in general, not just, you know, justice work. But sometimes like we wake up and we see what's happening in our world and we feel like, well, I can't avoid that, but I can't really deal with it either. So as a person who's, you know, committed a good part of your career to this, and also, like you said, like this is your life, this is your passion, what kind of encouragement do you have to the person listening who is struggling with their reality, whether that's their personal reality or the reality of the world, but still like has this desire for like a better tomorrow? What would you say to that person?
Well, for me, yeah, when I walk down the halls of our shelter and I see kiddos that are 7, 8, and 9, which is the 3 years I had the most fluctuation in child welfare, I'm immediately triggered by that time. I have a physical reaction. I feel I'm very emotional. It is a reminder very quickly of that pain point during that time. And I think people in general have those pain points and those triggers. And we throw the word PTSD around a lot, like we discredit it, that it's used so frequently now because it was unknown for so long. And it's such a real term that like depression or any mental health terms shouldn't be dismissed, but it often is because people, you know, will make jokes. Even in my family, my kids will say, having a PTSD moment. And it's great because they're just trying to make light of something difficult, which is awesome. But I always say, they're like, I know, Mom, don't forget it's real, because it is. And usually when we're having it. And I think it's really important to recognize that everybody has that in their life, because everybody has their stuff. Everybody has their triggers. Everybody has the things that hurt them, and they're no less important or more important than someone else's. They just are theirs. And I think so, for one, I think everybody being generally aware of that and trying to live a life of empathy, that's happening to everyone around you. It doesn't make yours less important, but it does help you remember that we're all in the same shared space to a certain degree. And for me, I just have a very strong belief system that, kind of like when I talked about my text messages, I will start reaching out, right? If I'm having a bad day, the first thing I do, because I've practiced it enough and I know it just works for me, it's not like, oh, I'll give it a shot, this is what works for me, is I go into a place of gratitude fast as I can. And I start reaching out to people and telling them I love them and asking if they're okay, because it's helping me also change. I don't forget them, but it's helping me change my trajectory. And it doesn't take that away. It doesn't take the issue away, but it does alter my state of mind to be able to have a perspective that I can heal. If you are a spiritual or religious or any, whatever, you know, person that believes in any higher power, or anything greater than themselves, I think taking a moment, for me, that's done through meditation. It's a type of prayer I have. And whatever that looks like for anybody, even if it's not your belief system, but you can pause and you can take three cycles of four breaths in and four breaths out. You can take that moment to bring your nervous system down, and you can find a place of gratitude, even one thing. And it can be the smallest of things. I'm grateful that I'm going to choose to move forward right now when this is really hard. That might just be enough for you today. And that's awesome. I think if you can initially force yourself to do it, because it's not going to be easy till it's a habit. It takes about 3 weeks to form a habit. Everyone knows that's proven. I think if you can force it, and then pretty soon it does become a way of life, what you'll find is it will now come naturally to you, and you won't force it. And you will start living more of a life of gratitude. And again, it doesn't take away from the fact that you have pain points and that things hurt and that life is hard and that information's coming at you so fast you're trying to learn how to decipher it. It's about taking time to pause and to breathe and to pray and to meditate or do whatever those things, those practices look like for you, to give yourself and honor yourself some space, to give yourself grace, to forgive yourself for anything that you've wronged yourself even for, which allows you, you know, the drill. The more you can forgive yourself, the more you can forgive others. I think all those habits of behavior that you can constantly throw in your life that really do get to the habits will completely change your trajectory. Again, not of what's happening to you, but how you handle it. And I think the how you handle it is far greater than what's actually happening to you. I just do. I feel like there's only a couple options on how you can handle it. And that is, you know, the only way in my world, the only way is through. And that's what you do. You figure it out. Or you can sit in it. Maybe you pause and think about it. But I think you have to move forward. We always had a rule in my family with my children that it also is important to feel the emotion you're supposed to feel. Don't dismiss it. So I would tell my kids, if you wake up sad tomorrow, or you wake up angry, or you wake up however you feel, you wake up happy, please take a moment and honor that feeling. Honor it, acknowledge it. I'm really mad at this person today, or I'm really sad that happened to me, or gosh, I feel really happy today. Whatever that is, honor it. If you need a day to be sad about something, if you need a day to be angry about it, come tell me and we get the next 24 hours for you to sit in that emotion, because you're acknowledging it. But after that 24 hours, you're going to move forward. That was just kind of a rule in my house. You get the 24 hours and I want you to take it, but then you will move forward. Now, a week later, you may need another 24 hours, and that's okay too. But it's really about that habit of we pause, we reflect, we feel, we move forward. We pause, we reflect, you know what I mean? Because I think you have to have like very good habits that you start creating, because I agree with you. I think it's, the world has gotten more complicated. It's gotten bigger. It's gotten harder. It's information is so fast. News can be misleading and we don't even know what's right coming at us. People seem angry all the time. You know, it's just like, it's a lot. And I think it's okay to acknowledge it, that it's a lot. But I'll tell you, it is very fun to also find the beauty in a lot of things. I'm a migraine person, so I get headaches probably half of the month. And I can sit in my office, I can look out my window, and I can still work through the headache and look out at the trees this time of year and say, oh, that's right, I remember. This is when all the white flowers come on those three trees in the yard out here. And when I do that, the headache doesn't disappear. It's still there. It's still obnoxious. But I can tell you it makes it a heck of a lot easier. And you know what I mean? To feel some sense of peace and look at nature and be appreciative of something that's happening. So I think it's in the small things, you know. I just think it's in the things we have to consciously look for. I think living with purpose is very important. That's one of my favorite sayings. Living with intention, making purposeful decisions, and not letting life just lead you every day.
Special thanks to Celeste Edmonds for joining the show today. If you want to get your hands on Garbage Bag Girl or just follow what she's got going on, go to CelesteEdmonds.com. That's CelesteEdmonds.com.